Unit 7.
Oliver Barrett IV, a Harvard student from a wealthy WASP family, fell in love with Jennifer, a Radcliffe music major, daughter of a pastry chef of Italian descent. Jennifer returned his love. The two of them started talking about marriage, thinking they were made for each other. A banker and a squeamish parent, Oliver Barrett III refused to give his blessing to the proposed alliance. Oliver and Jennifer thereupon went ahead on their own, contented with their love in a cottage. We join the novel in Chapter 13, 3 years after Oliver married Jennifer, regardless of his father's fierce opposition. One day, they received an invitation from Oliver's parents to the old man's 60th birthday party. Jennifer preferred accepting the invitation, regarding it as a good opportunity for a reconciliation between father and son, but Oliver wouldn't give it a thought. Thus, the two of them had a violent quarrel.
Love Story by Eric Siegel. Chapter 13. Mr. and Mrs. Oliver Barrett III request the pleasure of your company at a dinner in celebration of Mr. Barrett's 60th birthday, Saturday, the 6th of March at 7 o'clock, Dover House, Ipswich, Massachusetts. RSVP. Well, asked Jennifer. Do you even have to ask? I replied. I was in the midst of abstracting the State versus Percival, a very important precedent in criminal law. Jenny was sort of waving the invitation to bug me. I think it's about time, Oliver, she said. For what? For you know very well what, she answered. Does he have to crawl here on his hands and knees? I kept working as she worked me over. Ollie, he's reaching out to you. Bullshit, Jenny. My mother addressed the envelope. I thought you said you didn't look at it, she sort of yelled. Okay, so I did glance at it earlier. Maybe it had slipped my mind. I was, after all, in the midst of abstracting the State versus Percival and in the virtual shadow of exams. The point was, she should have stopped haranguing me. Ollie, think, she said, her tone kind of pleading now. 60 goddamn years old. Nothing says he'll still be around when you're finally ready for the reconciliation. I informed Jenny in the simplest possible terms that there would never be a reconciliation, and would she please let me continue my studying? She sat down quietly, squeezing herself onto a corner of the sofa where I had my feet. Although she didn't make a sound, I quickly became aware that she was looking at me very hard. I glanced up. Someday, she said, when you're being bugged by Oliver V, he won't be called Oliver. Be sure of that, I snapped at her. She didn't raise her voice, though she usually did when I did. Listen, all. If we name him Bozo the Clown, that kid's still going to resent you because you were a big Harvard athlete. And by the time he's a freshman, you'll probably be in the Supreme Court. I told her that our son would definitely not resent me. She then inquired how I could be so certain of that. I couldn't produce evidence. I mean, I simply knew our son would not resent me. I couldn't say precisely why. Jenny then remarked, Your father loves you too, Oliver. He loves you just the way you'll love Bozo. But you Barretts are so damn proud and competitive, you'll go through life thinking you hate each other. If it weren't for you, I said jokingly. Yes, she said. The case is closed, I said, being, after all, the husband and head of the household. My eyes returned to the State versus Percival, and Jenny got up, and then she remembered. There's still the matter of the RSVP. I said that a Radcliffe music major could probably compose a nice little negative RSVP without professional guidance. Listen, Oliver, she said, I've probably lied or cheated in my life, but I've never deliberately hurt anyone. I don't think I could. Really, at that moment she was only hurting me, so I asked her politely to handle the RSVP in whatever manner she wished, as long as the essence of the message was that we wouldn't show unless hell froze over. I returned once again to the State versus Percival. "What's the number?" I heard her say very softly. She was at the telephone. "Can't you just write a note? In a minute I'll lose my nerve. What's the number?" I told her and was instantly immersed in Percival's appeal to the Supreme Court. I was not listening to Jenny. That is, I tried not to. She was in the same room, after all. "Oh, good evening, sir," I heard her say. She had her hand over the mouthpiece. "Ollie, does it have to be negative?" The nod of my head indicated that it had to be. The wave of my hand indicated that she should hurry up. "I'm terribly sorry," she said into the phone. "I mean, we're terribly sorry, sir. We're..." Did she have to involve me in this? And why can't she get to the point and hang up? "Oliver!" She had her hand on the mouthpiece again and was talking very loud. "He's wounded, Oliver. Can you just sit there and let your father bleed?" Had she not been in such an emotional state, I could have explained once again that stones do not bleed. But she was very upset, and it was upsetting me too. "Oliver," she pleaded, "could you just say a word? To him. She must be out of her mind. I mean, like just maybe, hello." She was offering the phone to me and trying not to cry. "I will never talk to him, ever," I said with a perfect calm. And now she was crying, nothing audible, but tears pouring down her face. And then she begged. "For me, Oliver, I've never asked you for anything. Please." Three of us just standing. I somehow imagined my father being there as well, waiting for something. What? For me? I couldn't do it. Didn't Jenny understand she was asking possible? That I would have done absolutely anything else? As I looked at the floor, shaking my head in adamant refusal and extreme discomfort, Jenny addressed me with a kind of whispered fury I had never heard from her. "You are a heartless bastard," she said, and then she ended the telephone conversation with my father saying, "Mr. Barrett, Oliver does want you to know that in his own special way..." She paused for breath. She had been sobbing, so it wasn't easy. I was much too astonished to do anything but await the end of my alleged message. "Oliver loves you very much," she said, and hung up very quickly. There is no rational explanation for my actions in the next split second. I must never be forgiven for what I did. I ripped the phone from her hand, then from the socket, and hurled it across the room. "God damn you, Jenny! Why don't you get the hell out of my life?" I stood still, panting like the animal I had suddenly become. Jesus Christ! What the hell had happened to me? I turned to look at Jen, but she was gone. I mean, absolutely gone, because I didn't even hear footsteps on the stairs. Christ, she must have dashed out the instant I grabbed the phone. Even her coat and scarf were still there. The pain of not knowing what to do was exceeded only by that of knowing what I had done. I searched everywhere. In the law school library, I prowled the rows of grinding students, looking and looking, up and back at least half a dozen times. Though I didn't utter a sound, I knew my glance was so intense, my face so fierce, I was disturbing the whole place. Who cares? But Jenny wasn't there. Then all through Harkness Commons, the lounge, the cafeteria, then a wild sprint to look around Agassiz Hall at Radcliffe. Not there either. I was running everywhere now, my legs trying to catch up with the pace of my heart. Payne Hall, ironic goddamn name. Downstairs are piano practice rooms. I know Jenny. When she's angry, she pounds the keyboard, right? But how about when she's scared to death? It's crazy walking down the corridor. Practice rooms on either side. The sounds of Mozart and Bartok, Bach and Brahms filter out from the doors and blend into this weird, infernal sound. Jenny's got to be here. Instinct made me stop at a door, where I heard the pounding sound of a Chopin prelude. I paused for a second. The playing was lousy, stops and starts and many mistakes. At one pause, I heard a girl's voice mutter, "Shit." It had to be Jenny, I flung open the door. A Radcliffe girl was at the piano. She looked up, an ugly, big-shouldered, hippie Radcliffe girl, annoyed at my invasion. "What's the matter, man?" she asked. "Sorry," I replied, and closed the door again. Then I tried Harvard Square. Nothing. Where would Jenny have gone? I just stood there, lost in the darkness of Harvard Square, not knowing where to go or what to do next. A colored guy approached me and inquired if I was in need of a fix. I kind of absently replied, "No, thank you, sir." I wasn't running now. I mean, what was the rush to return to the empty house? It was very late, almost 1 a.m., and I was numb, more with fright than with cold, although it wasn't warm, believe me. From several yards off, I thought I saw someone sitting on the top of the steps. This had to be my eyes playing tricks, because the figure was motionless. But it was Jenny. She was sitting on the top step. I was too tired to panic, too relieved to speak. Inwardly, I hoped she had some blunt instrument with which to hit me. "Jen? Ollie?" We both spoke so quietly, it was impossible to take an emotional reading. "I forgot my key," Jenny said. I stood there at the bottom of the steps, afraid to ask how long she had been sitting, knowing only that I had wronged her terribly. "Jenny, I'm sorry." "Stop." She cut off my apology, then said very quietly, "Love means not ever having to say you're sorry." I climbed up the stairs to where she was sitting. "I'd like to go to sleep, okay?" she said. "Okay." We walked up to our apartment. As we undressed, she looked at me reassuringly. I meant what I said, Oliver, and that was all.